Welcome to Radio Survivor. We're here for the love of radio and sound. I'm Jennifer Waits.
I'm Paul Riesmandel.
Hello, everybody. I'm Eric Klein.
On the show today, we're excited to bring back two of our favorite scholars, Jennifer Lynn Stover and Hannah McGregor, to talk about podcasting, sound studies, and the often under-acknowledged labor behind this work. Jennifer Lynn Stover is Associate Professor of English at Binghamton University and co-founder and editor-in-chief of Sounding Out, the Sound Studies blog, as well as author of The Sonic Color Line. And also Hannah McGregor, who is Assistant Professor of Publishing at Simon Fraser University, as well as co-director of the Amplify Podcast Network and co-creator of Witch Please, a feminist podcast on the world of Harry Potter. Hannah and Jennifer, thanks for joining us once again on Radio Survivor.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So we've been having a lot of conversations behind the scenes at Radio Survivor about work-life balance and burnout. And it seems like it's been a challenging year and a half or longer for a lot of people. Well, for everyone, really.
Everyone on Earth. Isn't that nice,
who's
though?
Been having a good time?
Yeah.
I know.
Everyone on Earth is living through very similar challenges, but everyone has a different load to bear.
Exactly.
Oh, Eric, I already disagree with you.
Some people are fine.
I think some people have lived through an incredibly minor challenge and other people are living through a truly devastating challenge.
Some of the greatest privilege people are probably doing okay.
Yeah. Those dudes going to space and down in the same day.
Yeah, they're fine.
Some dudes are going to space.
Important to have those caveats. But, you know, I know that, you know, personally, you know, there have been strains on work and school and home life, you know, for everyone that I know. And that's part of what is framing our conversation today as we think about how we're all maintaining our mental health, our physical health, our relationships, our work demands. And radio and podcasting isn't immune, you know, to all of this, nor is Radio Survivor, you know, to be honest. So I know that that both of you are extremely busy and you've managed podcast projects in addition to your main academic work. And so I thought maybe we start out talking about how you manage that additional labor of podcasting and editing shows when you have all these other demands on you.
We should direct a question.
You got to tell us which one of us is going to talk.
Hannah McGregor.
Damn it.
you're up.
Okay. Yes. I'm going to say two things, but I'm going to say both of them in a really long way. So get ready. So the two things that I want to talk about are the concept of invisible labor and the problem of doing non-traditional work in a university. So here's a thing about doing non-traditional work in a university. Our universities love it. They love when we are doing work with a higher profile. They love when we are doing work that gets media coverage. They love when we are doing work that gets downloads and has obvious like applicability to people's actual lives. It's so good for like the branding of the university and the PR of the university. And for the most part, institutions are still unwilling to recognize that as actual work, which means the expectation becomes that you do that in addition to everything that everybody else is also doing.
And that keeps rising. The thing that everyone else is doing keeps rising and rising, too, on top of it. I've just been clapping silently over here to everything.
Right? The expectations keep going up. Yeah. Yeah. So like that's a big piece of it, a big piece of why those of us doing non-traditional things are so tired is because we're like also publishing peer-reviewed books at the same time as doing podcasts, even though the podcasts are as much work as the peer-reviewed books. And we do the publicly engaged stuff, the community engaged stuff, the non-traditional stuff, for the most part, because it's values driven. Because we want, you know, like I make podcasts because I want to talk to communities outside of the university, because I want to have conversations with people who aren't academics, because I think that knowledge should be for everyone. like my podcasting is really rooted in like a feminist approach to scholarship. And because it's values driven, it's easier for the institution to extract double the labor from me. So it's that's thing one.
Yeah, which I should add, people who are not in the academic world know exactly what you're talking about when it comes to volunteer community media.
Yes.
Same deal.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Right? It's that mm-hmm. it's the do what you love trap of late capitalism, which is mm-hmm. do what you love and we can undervalue it and not pay you for it. Which is, I mean, we can talk about hope labor at some point. Let's put a pin in that. Let's talk about hope labor at some point.
I will make sure we don't miss that. I love it.
Yeah. But the other thing that I think a lot about podcasting and the concept of invisible labor is invisible to whom? Which is a question I always ask when we talk about mm-hmm. invisible labor. Because there... There are lots of, okay, so my context here is academic, and it is like dudes who have started making a podcast and their minds are blown by how much work it is, and all of a sudden they're like, oh, nobody's talking about invisible labor. And it's like, bitch, who do you think publishes your journal articles? Like, somebody, I'm sorry for all the profanity. Somebody is typesetting your books. Somebody is copy editing your books. Yeah. Somebody is managing the production of your books.
Someone drives the truck.
Somebody drives the look. Like, so much labor is going into your everything that we produce, the complex infrastructure of knowledge production. And if you don't think of that as invisible labor, it might be because you just don't see it, period. And so I am wary when we talk about podcasting as involving invisible labor, as though there isn't huge amounts of labor involved in literally every form of knowledge production. Yes. And as though what labor is invisible and what labor is visible isn't like a deeply political question.
Yes. Yes.
Jenny, do you want to expand on that?
Oh, yes, I do. Oh, my goodness. Like, my brain is going in 50 different directions. Like, that just made me think of how, you know, we stopped sounding out during the pandemic. We were on a very long pause for approximately a year for exactly those reasons, because it is something we actually talk about, like the labor of love that is sounding out. There's an article we did in the Digital Sound Studies book that came out on Duke a couple years ago, where we actually kind of tell our origin story and how all of this came about. And we kind of end with that question, like, are we just now, you know, in trying to find something that we love and that we could commit ourselves to that could be our own, are we just now value added to the university and now making everyone's job harder because now they're going to be expected to also do something that they, you know, love and care about in addition to all the other stuff they're supposed to love and care about. So we've been really concerned about that all the way through. So our immediate decision was to pause. We did not want to feel as if we were extracting academic labor from others. Last thing I wanted to do is be writing emails about where's your essay when I don't know, you know, what people's life situations yeah. are. Yeah. In addition to our own. And then we also didn't want to contribute to the publishing inequity that's currently going on, where, you know, we were talking about some people having it easier during the pandemic, where people who aren't caregivers, people who aren't in debt, people who don't have the same kind of teaching loads, people who, you know, for some people who don't have, you know, are removed from some of the immediate sickness and death, are publishing at much higher rates and sending things out. And there's you know, going to be a couple year bubble where caregivers are behind, or I should say they're doing what they should do. Everyone else is accelerating out of self-interest and opportunism. So we didn't want to contribute to that. We wanted to maintain the equity in our publishing, and that was really important to us. We started up again in April and we're maintaining fairly well. But recently we've had to pause again just because everything else has gone up. You know, like we were saying, the teaching demands have gone up. We are now kind of caregivers to our students by expectation from the university, in addition to our love and care that we provide as educators. So it's just been really difficult. And I have to say, people have not been so kind in their writing. It's now, you know, I feel like the more readers we got and the kind of bigger Sounding Out is perceived to be, the more people treat us as if we work for them or we're kind of serving them or we are secretaries or, and not that you should treat secretaries that way either, I'm just saying. But now I know how some of those people treat the assistants that help them out, because I get those emails.
Because I'm the person who said everyone's dealing with the pandemic at the same time, I also want to mention that I just read an article that young people are experiencing a lot more disruption and stress than older people during the pandemic.
Yes.
That the so-called Gen Z cohort is really, and it makes sense that they're
and there are students.
Yeah. Their lives have been disrupted in a way that is different from older workers.
Well, and the Surgeon General of the United States this week, you know, made this kind of unprecedented statement about, I think it was focused on teens specifically, and, you know, depression and anxiety being a crisis, which any of us who are parents of teenagers right now are well aware of that. But I thought it was very striking to hear this from a government official, you know, acknowledging, and we're hearing this certainly, you know, where I am, that all of the schools, you know, all of the elementary and high schools are having, you know, unprecedented behavior challenges. Students and teachers are having a rough time. And
yeah, I guess we should maybe ask specifically what kind of, you said you're being asked to be caregivers to your young adult students. How is that manifesting in at the places where you teach?
Well, it's manifesting in, like, we have this whole very elaborate new digital architecture for like noting changes in students' behavior, for noticing grades up and down. We have all this we've had, you know, just many conversations about, you know, exactly about, you know, the specific challenges that students have. Also, for, I feel like we're somewhat responsible for like keeping them enrolled or keeping them in the game of school. Like, it's not expressly stated, but it's stated in every kind of way that, you know, my university went full open this fall in person, and we are not allowed to teach online. We're not allowed to have Zoom classes. So that alone is saying that. And you know, as a humanities professor, we're already, I feel like, bearing a lot of that load of caregiving to students and, you know, watching them. And, you know, I've been doing this. I've been teaching, actually, for almost 30 years. I started as a high school teacher in 1996. So it's been a long time for me. And this is the most intense it's ever been. So knowing that about everybody wanting Sounding Out to keep just churning along just did not feel right. But a lot of folks, you know, I feel like we didn't start it to be a line on people's CV, and that I feel like now they're getting pressured to be productive. So then we're getting pressured to make sure that their stuff comes out. And, you know, meanwhile, we're still the same small volunteer organization that we've always been. And, you know, that's something I've been trying to kind of grapple with this year, and keeping it going because we love to do it, but finding a way to make it sustainable, and you know, that we don't let people down, but at the same time that, you know, there's some kindness in return, or some grace in the sense of, you know, that we are all doing this unpaid and in addition to everything else.
Jenny, that Jenny Stover, that's really touching something in me, because I've heard this across like all sorts of industries that people are having crankier exchanges with their customers, clients, readers, listeners. And I'm wondering, you know, I'll ask you and also ask Hannah if you have any advice on how do we get people to understand and show grace to those of us who are producing these things out of love and you know, through our own hard work. You know, how do you respond? I mean, my tendency is to ignore some of the cranky comments, but maybe you have some better advice than that.
Jenny, you can take that first, and then.
Say, I think that's a pretty good. That is a pretty good strategy. I really just speak as how I you know, with respect, and you know, I don't, sometimes I'll take a day if it's one that especially touched a nerve. I don't immediately respond. I give myself a chance to, you know, walk the dog a zillion times and kind of decompress and then respond. But a lot of times, you know, because they may not know the story of us, they may not know that it's such a small yeah. group. They may not know that. And sometimes I, you know, very kindly just talk about a little bit about us and why, you know, we've had to do what we've had to do without it being like defensive or without it being, but just kind of letting people know that we do take time and care with it. And that's the other thing, you know, is because we do developmental editing, which is the written equivalent of what you've been doing, Eric, with audio editing. We do go through and take the time with the pieces, and we hand select all the photographs. We do all the layout ourselves. Like, it's kind of, you know, it's important to be able to take that care. So we let them know that you know, that's part of why it's a slow process.
Yeah. Publishing is hard work, and it is work that is, again, like, it's treated as functionary work, and functionary work people tend to have, one, to call invisible, but also two, to like just have less respect mm-hmm. for the fact that it's done by humans. I have so many friends who work in publishing who have said, like, I have been endlessly compassionate with my authors and the fact that they are struggling, and given them endless accommodations and extensions, and they direct none of that compassion back to me, right? Mm. They're like, oh, I'm struggling, please give me more time. But then when you're like, I'm sorry, I can't turn these edits around as quickly as I normally would, they're like, how dare you? Mm. Don't you know I'm struggling? Edit faster. And it is that, like, you know, we create these hierarchies of labor. I see this in the university, that like faculty are allowed to be struggling and students are allowed to be struggling, but staff are expected mm-hmm. to suck it up and keep the institution running. And it is that, like, the categories of labor that are about, like, helping other people make things, we often don't value them a lot, and we often treat the people who do them like they are tools rather than humans. Yeah. So, like, I think you've got two options. You can ignore them, or you can send them an email back gently reminding them that you're a human being.
Yeah. As a former university staffer who was in media production, I mean, I felt that all the time. And I could see it in fellow staffers who, over the years, would just become embittered. And they were the folks who sort of has the stereotype of, well, they, you know, they don't want to be bothered to do their job, right? But I would realize it was mostly because they'd felt taken for granted and not had their work respected. Yeah. And, you know, and it was a challenge. Of course, then my favorite faculty and administrators were those who did make that recognition, and they exist, right? But it wasn't something you could take for granted always was going to happen, and that would always happen. And you could see that the real material outcomes on both these people's lives, other staffers. And then also then it has this larger long-term effect of disaffection, and the disaffection can become rather, viral, if you will, and spread, because you see from, you know, you, the attitude is quickly contagious. And we're hoping we're not being contagious about a bad attitude here. We're talking to some positive things as well. And that's not a dig. I just want people to know they're listening to Radio right. Survivor, and where we're here for the love of radio and sound. I'm Paul Riesmandel. Most recently, you heard from Hannah McGregor, who is an assistant professor of publishing at Simon Fraser University. We're also talking with Jenny Stover, who's an associate professor of English at Binghamton University, and both of whom are scholars and podcasters and independent publishers. And we're sort of recognizing that parallel between independent publishing and podcasting and in the academy, how it's valued on the one hand, but as you put it to Hannah very succinctly, you know, also invisible labor, right? That it's and there's so much that goes into all of this, beyond even the person doing the writing, it's the person doing the editing, the publishing that goes on. And that really starts to weigh on us. Jenny, you mentioned that you put your blog sounding out on pause, and it's an academic blog. It's an edited blog, and you put it on pause during the pandemic. And I'm wondering, how hard was that decision for you and your co-editors to make that? Was it easy, or did you have in the back of your head that worrying about the nasty comments and the complaints coming in?
It was instantaneous, actually. Like, when there was the shutdown, we immediately, they don't call us the hive mind for nothing. Like, we just immediately emailed each other, texted each other, and we, you know, it was first and foremost. Like, that is one thing we have been, you know, as a principle of ours, is more humane labor practices. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't make things due on holidays. We don't make things due January 1st. Like, just nightmares of things are due on January 1st. You know, we really try to be mindful of when things are due, giving people time. You know, that's always been built into our model already. And so that was just almost immediate. Plus, you know, I'm a single mom with a kid at home who couldn't go to school all of a sudden. Liana Silva, our managing editor, also a single parent teaching high school in Houston. Like, it was just physically impossible to do all of those things at once. And also having to retrain myself how to teach online, or I should say train myself for the first time how to teach online. And just knowing that if we were going through that, then all of our writers would be going through that. And, you know, and we didn't want to, this model of pressing on through things just to press on is not something we're invested in. We also didn't want to, like, I guess, profiteer or be suddenly publishing things that are just like, oh, sound in the pandemic, like 2 weeks into it. Like that, you know, we really wanted to be reflective. And you probably wouldn't be surprised at the pitches I got that fast. And we just said no, like that's not something we want to contribute to. Yeah. So that was, you know, for us, it was an easy one. I mean, it's hard not to do it because I do miss it. And I really, you know, that's been some of the hardest times of my life. Sounding out was the one thing I was still like able to get through in terms of work. Like that was, you know, when my dad was sick, and I was still doing that. But like then we knew it was going to be big, and we had to act fast to ease people's stress levels.
Hannah, how are your projects going? I mean you are with all of this, right? You're co-director of the Amplify Podcast Network. You've got your own podcast, Which Please. You know, have you continued on? Have you wrestled with it? How's it going?
Yeah, some things stopped. I stopped making Secret Feminist Agenda maybe mm-hmm. 6 months into the pandemic.
Another podcast of yours.
Another podcast of mine that I had been thinking about continuing on into a fourth season. And I had this whole idea about doing sort of a mentorship model in the fourth season that brought in other producers to make episodes. And I was just like, I am so tired. Yeah. And I am like, I am not a caregiver. And I have I'm in a research position, so I have a comparatively low, like, I am that person who has all of those advantages Jenny was talking about, and I am so tired. So I was like, I can't ask anybody to do anything more right now. So I was just like, we're done. Secret Feminist Agenda is done. And then people were like, oh, we're sad. And I was like, too bad. Go back and listen to the old episodes. I don't know what to say to you.
Were those complaints or were they more like, I'm sad? Because, I mean, there is a difference.
No, they were loving.
They were loving. Okay, that's
yeah.
Good.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. I think my students are going to be excited. I'm talking to the Secret Feminist Agenda. I'm teaching a podcast in class right now. My graduate students are really into your work. Yeah.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. I mean, I loved making it. And I think we don't give enough space for, like, we start things because we love them. Why aren't we allowed to end them because we're done loving them now?
Yeah.
Like, I loved making it, and then it stopped making me happy, and so I stopped making it.
And this has always been on my mind, and now more than ever, whose idea was it that something has to happen every 7 days? And why?
Yeah, I mean, that is something I wanted to put out there. Yeah. What do you think of that? Because it's advice that podcasters, you know, outside the everywhere get, right? And but I've talked to, you know,
all content
I've
creators,
talked to definitely right? lots of academics who want to start a podcast, really worried. You know, I keep hearing it has to be every week. It has to be every, you know, and pick a time. And it's Monday at noon. And if it doesn't drop, and I work in podcasting and I have worked at a podcast, a comedy network, and I've seen the onslaught of social media complaints when their cherished improv comedy show isn't in their feed first thing Monday morning. Mm-hmm. So I get it.
Their free show.
But also, I mean, their free show, right, that they don't pay for. But also, I mean, it makes me wonder. I mean, Hannah, what do you think? Is that really necessary to begin with? It's right. I'm just thinking of your background in publishing because of and the way you look at it critically, right? Because there's a lot I think maybe bundled up in that exhaustion of having to do it weekly.
Can I save Hannah from answering the question for a moment?
No, oh. I know the answer.
Oh, okay. Okay, I just wanted to add. I'll add something after you answer.
Yeah.
Okay. My answer is yes and no. Eric, what do you want to add?
Why community radio is a non-commercial, non-paying enterprise, and volunteer lifeblood. That's you know, those are the watchwords that have been driven through my brain for 30, 20 years. Why is it on the same schedule as commercial radio? I mean, it's necessary, but it's also very taxing. It's very taxing to ask volunteers to accomplish work on a schedule the same way you'd ask someone working at the Ford car assembly line to complete their work.
Yeah.
You gave a yes and no. Please.
Yeah. My answer is that there are best practices in every media world, in every publishing genre, and those best practices have emerged often for a reason. You know, the reason why it's best practice to produce your podcast on a regular basis is because it increases listener engagement. Listeners like regularity. They like the episode arriving predictably on a schedule. And the more frequently you can release it, the more engaged listeners will become. So if you can up from once a week to twice a week, you're going to get more listener engagement. You're probably going to get higher numbers. Like that's the reality. You know, similarly, it's the reality, like, why does copy editing happen as part of the production of books? Well, because that is part of the practice of how we produce error-free books. And then people look at, like, a Kindle Unlimited romance novel and complain about the fact that it wasn't copy edited. And it's like, oh, you're missing the point. You're applying the norms of publishing in one environment to a totally different environment where those norms no longer apply. And I think that's what we tend to do is that increasingly, as like we're all supposed to have these like professional caliber side hustles, it's like make your amateur podcast indistinguishable in quality and production methods from professional podcasts where whole teams of producers are being paid to make them. Like, well, why? Like, yeah, that's the best practice if you're NPR. Sure, great. But I'm not. So, what is it the best practice for me? It might not be. It might be actually totally inapplicable to my situation.
And Jennifer Stover is nodding. This reminds me of conversations we've had about the Sounding Out podcast. So
yes, one of our worst critical emails came about because of the sound of our podcast. Someone who was very audiophilic, and this was even 5 years ago. Like, it's worse, as you mentioned now. Everybody, I mean, I'm teaching a podcast class, and it's a struggle thinking about sound with people who are very new to it, who are doing, you know, studying graduate studies full time, learning how to edit for the first time. And so, you know, Aaron Trammell, our podcast editor, had put out our 51st podcast. He put out a manifesto about why our podcast sound is so uneven. And it's a great post because it talks about just us wanting to increase access, that we don't want to only, you know, take professional pieces or pieces from people who have the audio training. And, you know, part of the reason why I'm teaching the podcast class is so many people don't get audio training anywhere. And especially if they are women, especially if they're people of color, that you know, we need to teach it somehow and somewhere. And so we don't want to close off our sound to only those privileged voices that have that kind of time editing or ability not to sleep. So we can, you know, get that kind of sound. And sometimes it, you know, it actively interferes with the kind of tape we're able to get. So that's our stance. It's, I think it's called our Manifesto on Podcasting, or our 51st episode. You can check it out. So thank you to that person for writing that terrible email. So we can actually, like, you know, justify this and actually think it through as to why that was important to us. Not just, oh, like, we were being haphazard about it.
Right. It can be meaningful. Hannah, you sort of stepped up to the line, I think, on you asked the question and sort of answered of why, you know, does it need to be almost, you know, why does it need to be of, like, say, paid professional level, right? Why do all our side hustles, right? And I think, you know, and I'll say, I think it's because embedded is there's the assumption that, right, you called it a side hustle, that we ought to turn this thing into our job, right? And if we're going to do that, because the audience goes from being a community to the product, right? Ostensibly, for most podcasting that makes money, it's through advertising. And in advertising, I work in advertising, the audience is the product.
Yes. 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 And so all of those best practices are about building up the largest, most engaged possible audience so that you can sell that audience to potential future advertisers.
But there's another dream, though, that I just want to step in. Like, the other dream is that you've built a show that you share with an audience that they become they sign up for one of these increasingly problematic startup businesses that are increasing shareholder value and not valuing the community that they serve. And that's another story. But, like, the idea, you don't always dream of building something that gets enough audience for corporate sponsorship. Sometimes you dream of building something that's so beloved by a community that it's self-sustaining, and even that dream.
That's which, please.
Yeah.
So this is, you know, this is the other side of the sort of the unpaid labor of it all. Was Marcel and I started Which Please when we were both underemployed academics, and we carried it on as long as we could. And that at a certain point, the hours and hours and hours of production became unsustainable for us. And so we had to stop making the podcast. And I pitched to her a couple of years ago that I would like to start making it again. And she said, I will only make it if we can have a producer and can pay that producer an appropriate professional audio production wage. And so we went to a network and said, you know, are you interested in our show? Will you provide us with a producer? And they said, yes. And their model, this is Not Sorry, is the network that we're working with, which is an explicitly feminist podcasting network whose values are very, very rooted in paying people for their work. And so, you know, one, they insisted that Marcel and I start taking money for the show because they were like, nope, it's the value. You get paid for your work. And two, they were like, you're going to have a producer and that producer is going to get paid properly even before your show is making any money.
Producer
is going to get paid properly.
Tears are coming to my eyes.
And we use Patreon. Like, that was, they were like, we're distributed by Acast, and at some point they were assuming we would get ad deals, but our listenership is too geographically weird for us to be interesting to any advertisers. Like, we've got too many Dutch listeners. They're just like, what, we can't.
Stroop Waffles has no interest.
Yeah, exactly. But we have a really, really engaged listener base. And so we are supported through Patreon, and Patreon allows us to pay our producer so that it is a job that she is getting paid to do.
That's great. How did you organize your Patreon? Because we thought about that, but then sometimes I'm like, oh, that's a whole other level of work.
It's like, more
I gotta
labor.
Produce special things and make special things. And we worried about that.
One, the producer runs the Patreon, which rules.
Because
she gets paid.
This is great.
She gets paid out of the Patreon. So she's like actively invested.
It's like working
Patreon,
in public radio,
us
right?
More money.
It's being the development officer in public radio.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it does, you know, it adds to the work. It means that we've got to make more content, but it is so much, like, I laugh whenever people are like, I make a podcast. Oh yeah, my, you know, my friend produces it. I'm like, oh, you don't make a podcast. Your friend makes a podcast. You show up mm-hmm. and talk into a mic once a week. That's absolutely yes. not making a podcast. And so I barely feel like we make Witch Please anymore, because we show up when Coach, which is our nickname for our producer, we show up when Coach tells us to show up, and we record for the amount of time Coach tells us to record, and then Coach takes the audio and she makes it into a podcast, and then she posts it. Like, and it's not invisible labor. I see it. I know who's doing it. Coach is doing it, and we're paying her for it.
And
I like that so much more.
Yeah. Are you keeping a weekly cadence? Are you keeping a regular cadence? Or does working with Patreon give you a little more flexibility in your release cycle?
It's fortnightly, and we stick to a regular production schedule because and this is another piece of it, when you are working with multiple different people, regularity of production schedule is a way of respecting everybody's time.
Sure.
Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. So like, it got, you know, we've got to get the audio at a certain time so that Coach has enough time to edit the episode, and then Coach has to get it to the person at the network who mixes it so they have enough time to mix the episode. And if we were just sort of flying by the seat of our pants, then that person who's like set aside an afternoon to mix our episode is going to be like, what the f- you guys, I can't, I'm so sorry for how much I'm swearing.
I'll take care of that one, Eric.
Yeah. Just beep. I know you said you don't edit anymore, and I'm like, haha.
I'll take nice full try. Responsibility for this one, Eric.
It's 22 minutes from
I
the
wrote
conclusion.
It down. Yes. Yeah. The person who just made me had to edit this episode of Radio Survivor is Hannah McGregor, who is a co-creator of the podcast Witch Please. I am Paul Riesmandel, and
I want to put in a plug for a very recent episode where we went deep on profanity and indecency and described the reason why somebody is going to have to do invisible labor to remove the F-bomb from the radio, but not from the web. It's fascinating. Recent episode online at radiosurvivor.com.
Yeah, go to our show notes at radiosurvivor.com. 100-year
history of the reason why you can't say certain words on the radio. It's not what you think. It's actually a completely different story than the conventional wisdom.
And that is Eric Klein, and Jennifer Waits is also here, along with our other guest, Jenny Stover from Binghamton University, as well as the Sounding Out, the Sound Studies blog and podcast. And we're talking about labor, invisible labor, volunteer labor, the things that it take to publish podcasts and radio and all sorts of things, and how much of it is unobserved and unnoticed and uncredited, but nevertheless adds up to making it difficult sometimes to keep really critical projects going. I wanted to, Hannah, you brought up the word hope labor. Yeah. Earlier, and you said you wanted to get back to it. So so I want to get back to it. I want to know, what is hope labor?
I think people who work at community radio and podcasting know all about it, even if they've never heard those words before. Yeah.
Yeah, you feel it in your bones, don't you? Hope labor is a term that was coined by, I think Kathleen Kuhn is her name, a scholar studying blogging and the sort of larger environment of sort of digital publishing for the sake of some form of self-promotion. And the idea of hope labor is that it is labor that you do for free based on the idea that eventually it will allow you to get to the point where you can be paid to do that thing. And so, you know, look at like the millions of people who have cooking blogs, and they are, you know, creating these, like writing these long narratives and creating these recipes and posting these beautiful photographs, and they're doing all of it for free in the hope that at some point they will get a cookbook deal, a cooking show, you know, that they'll get to do this thing. And that is the financial model of most forms of digital publishing, is we all do it for free in the hope that eventually it will be successful enough that we'll get paid for it.
Even the young people who are younger than teenagers right now are approaching Twitch streaming with that exact with that dream, and that's Amazon sort of set it up that way. There's this like carrot that they might do it, and it's like 11-year-olds doing hope labor on video game streaming.
Yeah, it makes me think also about social media and the whole new category. Well, it's not even that new anymore, of influencers. So people who are posting things and putting certain hashtags or tagging brands, you know, hoping that they are going to become an ambassador and become an influencer and suddenly get all these sponsorships.
Yeah. I mean, and I've been at a number of radio stations where that was explicitly the model, that even the best people running that station were like, we're pulling in volunteers with this, like, if things work out well for this place together, you know, the work you're doing will definitely get paid someday. And that the nicest people were lying to the faces of their coworkers.
Yeah, and it's endemic in a lot of industries that are perceived as desirable. So academia is full of hope labor, people writing, publishing, teaching for no or almost no pay in the hopes eventually they'll get a tenure track job. Unpaid internships are the norm in a lot of industries that are considered desirable. Do this work for free in the hope that eventually you'll get a job. But it's also something that a lot of corporate digital publishing platforms have taken advantage of and turned it into their entire business model. So they have gotten audiences hooked on the idea that all content should be free, and that eventually people, if people make stuff that's good enough, they'll get paid through ads, they'll get paid through attention, they'll get paid through likes. And so people feel no obligation to actually like pay for content ever, right? Because they're used to it just being given away for free. And then this carrot is constantly being offered, this possibility that you could be one of those billionaire YouTubers who buys custom sports cars, is sort of always held out as a way of encouraging people to continue to produce all of this content for free.
So taking that into account, I'm kind of curious, and I don't mean to put you on the spot, Jenny Stover, but I will a little bit in that. that's a terrible setup, and I apologize for it. So I'm thinking about like running your blog, right? You're running your Sounding Out blog, right? And which is obviously, you know, it's people are not, I don't believe people are able to be paid. Is that correct? Or am I making that up?
Yeah, none of us are paid. The people who we've paid any artists that we've used their images.
Awesome.
We've paid any, like the artists that designed our logo, but all that was out of pocket. And we paid translators if we've ever, you know, we published a piece that was on Casserole protests in Montreal. It was important to us to make sure that got published in French as well. So things like that, we managed to fund. We do have interns every semester that are paid through credit at Binghamton University. I work with interns, and there's a whole section there, and we promote their work and also, you know, make sure everyone knows which pieces they've done, and so they're kind of paid in credit, experience, and you know, letters of recommendation. But no, the rest of us aren't paid, and it's been tricky because, you know, oftentimes, I think for us, I was trying to think about how the hope labor works for us. And I feel like, because we never thought, I mean, back when we started, we're going on 11 or 12 years now, like the last 2 years are hazy. Like when we started, like the idea that people got paid for blogs was weird. Or not like, you know, it maybe was the cooking people that kind of kicked it off, or like the parenting blogs, things like that. But we had never imagined that to be how this might play out. But I also think like we like our autonomy, and that's something that's increasingly shrinking at the university along with everything else. And so, you know, everyone's like, well, why don't you, you know, get funding for this or funding for that? And knowing that funding comes with strings, and funding comes with proprietary rights for things, and you know, we don't like, there's no copyright on our blog. Like, we don't have, people can republish anywhere they want, they retain ownership over their work, it's open access. So, you know, that has been important to us to keep, and also with taking advertising, like what kind of advertising would we lose our credibility for? So we've had lots of fierce conversations about taking advertising and what that would mean. And so in some ways, it's been really hard for us to think about ways to monetize it because we don't want to, what we would give up for that. And that's the really for us, our struggle is yeah, the autonomy versus, you know, that kind of payment. But then if it's part of our day jobs, at least to run it, we would like to be able to pay our writers, especially our non, you know, writers who aren't in academia, who don't have day jobs, that they get some kind of value from this. Because a lot of people do get value from this right. kind of writing and the circulation.
Because I think what folks who are outside the academy don't always understand or realize is that, you know, it's understood as part of your job as a professor, particularly to publish in a lot of different ways. And you get credit, so to speak, for it from yes. your employer, and you'll be asked on a regular basis to actually, you know, provide an inventory of all these things yeah. that you've done.
You know, so we've fought to make sure that we're indexed through MLA. We've made sure that we maintain credibility by not taking weird advertising that mm-hmm. would cause a university to look at it and go, oh, no way, what is this? You know, it's So we've tried, you know, that is in some ways ensured that people will still get that kind of value from the work. And our hope was also to change the field. Like, that's why we started it, was because there was nowhere to publish for sound studies. We wanted to make sure that the people who were doing the most innovative work, who are the most precarious, who are the, you know, just starting out, who are not recognized in their various, because sound studies is dispersed. So you'd have people doing sound studies work in various fields where they're the only one at their campus and everyone thinks they're doing something strange. And so the hope for us was to build that community, build that recognition where conversations about race, gender, power, the stuff that moves through all these various kind of components of sound is at the center of the conversation, and that those folks will get recognized, get cited, even if, you know, it takes them years to break into the quote unquote traditional academic publishing. So that was kind of our hope. And you know, we're still continually working at that.
And I think that's what's really amazing and groundbreaking about the work that you do, Jenny Stover, and also that you do, Hannah McGregor, because Sounding Out, Jenny Stover, Sounding Out is a peer reviewed blog. And then Hannah McGregor, you've worked on peer reviewed podcasts. So, mm-hmm. and, you know, you're both, helping to legitimize this academic work that lots of people are doing outside of, you know, the traditional academy, which is, you know, has pluses and minuses, as we've been talking about for this entire hour today. So, Hannah, I don't know if you have like a quick kind of thought on all that, the complexity of, you know, advancing scholarship by including podcasting and blogging among peer-reviewed publications, but also that adding to the labor that we all do.
Yeah. I mean, it's tricky because it does, like, one of the reasons why it's so important to me to figure out a model for peer-reviewing podcasts is because I want us to be able to put them on our CVs. I want them to count as publications. I want us not to have to do them. And also traditional papers mm-hmm. if we don't want to. And so it is a matter of credit. It is a matter of absorbing it into the logic of a particular publishing environment that comes with downsides, as people have pointed out. Like, will drawing podcasting into the world of academia ruin podcasting? Probably. Academia ruins everything. And so I don't think that's not a risk. And also, academia is built on a huge amount of like free labor. And I put free labor in quotes because I am paid for it. Like, I am a tenure track professor at a university that pays me a salary that is including in that salary the assumption that I will not only publish, but will peer review other people's scholarship and render other kinds of service to the profession. And I'm being paid by a publicly funded institution to do so. But tenure track jobs are rarer and rarer, and more people are doing all of this work while literally not getting paid for it, because there's this tiny, either because there's a tiny thread of the possibility of getting a job, or even more insidiously, because it matters to us. And that is one of the real traps, is like, why do we do this? Because we deeply care about it.
Yeah. And also, the students aren't getting paid for their work. Wouldn't that be a world if, you know.
I mean, yeah, it depends, right? Like, graduate students have to do a lot of unpaid work in order to professionalize themselves.
Well, I just meant that.
And that is part of the classism of
even young people, who are learning, when, you know, it would be a world that would be a lot more egalitarian if, especially young adults, were paid for their work to learn in school, as opposed to the opposite. Wait, having to pay for it.
Wait, I'm sorry, you think we should pay students?
Yeah.
To be students?
Yeah, why not? They're working.
I think tuition should be free. I think I'm not sure if I'm convinced that students should be paid to attend school, but I think tuition should be free, and that would be a really strong step in the right direction.
Well, kind of putting that aside, you know, I wanted to put out a kind of a dichotomy, and get your opinions on it. And because I'm thinking about publishing in all of its forms here, and, you know, and each of you having projects, these peer reviewed, you know, intensely edited and reviewed projects that, you know, it seems like all, you know, with some minor exceptions, you know, the labor is all sort of donated. They are not for-profit enterprises, correct? Right? No, but right.
No. You,
Jenny, you specifically mentioned that you went out of your
way. Draining.
Right. Well,
for draining.
And I'm noting industries. As well, though, again, a lot of things that folks outside of academia probably don't know. A lot of journals are owned by for-profit publishers, right? And so even though the contributor, the writers, will write them without compensation from the journal, and in fact may have to, in order to access their article, their university will have to pay a lot of money to get the journal, right? Yes. But that the labor that goes into it, at least as far as the publisher is concerned, is free and donated. You know, I wonder, you know, never mind that it's still labor, is there a difference between that which at least you have, as you mentioned, Jenny, some autonomy and ownership of it, even if you're not paid, versus, frankly, someone else making money off of it and you don't? I'll start with you, Jenny. Is that a real dichotomy? Am I making that up?
No, I definitely think so. And that's one thing, you know, when the pandemic happened, one of the things I stopped doing for a minute was reviews. And that's because, you know, it was like my work, it was like triage at that point.
Reviews and, for and journals. Is that
for journals, yes. Because yes, we are expected to do as, you know, research reviews. But and the only journals I would say yes to were journals that could adequately respond to my questions about how they were managing COVID and the labor imbalances. Were they asking as many male scholars as you know, men scholars as women scholars? Because that's another thing, that's invisible work that's seen as it's kind of like academic care work to take on so many reviews, because those are invisible and private and blind. So I'd love to see, you know, journals, we very carefully manage the demographics of our publication, of our reviews, and the equity of that. And I would like to see, you know, journals making sure that they're actively, you know, working to get submissions from women, taking time if they need time, you know, all of those things. And so, you know, if a journal that couldn't respond to that, then I would say no. And I also have to shout out to Robin James over at JPMS, at the Journal for Popular Music Studies. She gave me such a wonderful, thoughtful response, and they really were taking that seriously. And, you know, it's something that we are a small part of, but we need to do more in terms of saying no and using our protected positions to ask for the kind of equity we want and need. So I think that's a big difference, that we are having constant conversations about that. We also build a community. Like, we're not just publishing. We don't just see ourselves as publishing. I think that's sometimes why we get so hurt when we get those emails, because it's like, you know, we have the kind of presence we do on the web. We connect people. We constantly, like, I've done the Twitter account free for 10 years. And I've, you know, every time someone who's ever published in Sounding Out publishes anything, I put it on there. Like, once you publish with us, you're like permanently with us, if that makes sense. And we kind of accrete that way. And we, you know, we've connected people, and, you know, we're not just something to kind of, you know, find in the library search engine. You know, there's a value to that, but that's not our purpose.
The what you just said, Jenny Stover, I just want to emphasize, because that was the dream of podcasting way back before the for-profit corporation Patreon came in and gave us a very good model to use to get paid, and before the companies that currently are doing pretty well figuring out how to monetize podcasts got paid. The dream was to build a community, at least some people's dream.
Yeah.
And people are doing that. I'm not like it, but it's a minority dream. Like to understand that your audience isn't there to help you make money off the work you're doing, but that your audience is there because they're a part of the work you're doing when you podcast. That you're that you know, maybe you have the microphone and they don't, but they're a part of the community. And that's the dream of community radio as well, despite having to ask that audience to pay for all the staff members at some point, all the paid staff members at some point.
Yeah.
It's just something I wanted to mention.
Yeah, I think it's the dream of a lot of forms of non-traditional publishing. You know, I always think that podcasting has so much of the same DNA as zine making.
Yeah.
Of just, yes, like, it is scrappy and amateur and independent and radical, and it is about making a public and making a community and saying something that you couldn't say in more mainstream ways because there isn't space for your voice in those mainstream platforms. And so you're like, screw it, I'll make it myself. Yeah. I will take up the means of production and produce my own thing.
And it's one of the privileges of being from Generation X is that there was no Instagram, there was no Facebook, there was no Twitter, there was no Patreon, there was no Kickstarter, there was no Twitch. That when you wanted to self-publish, there really weren't corporate tools to help you. So self-publishing zines, what really was as independent as anything ever could be in the 90s. And that's something that sadly all grandpa Gen Xers now are screaming at clouds, right? Trying to explain to kids that their dreams should include a little bit of, I've had this conversation with my son who has dreamed of Twitch streaming superstardom. I'm like, yes, but Amazon is in the way of your audience. And how can you connect with an audience without the corporations? And in a lot of the young people's hope, labor these days has a huge internet company between them and the audience. It's just the nature of things. This has been Radio Survivor. We're rounding out the radio show. Of course, we are also a podcast, and this conversation is going to continue on the podcast at radiosurvivor.com, anywhere where you get your streaming regular media. This has been Jennifer Stover, Associate Professor of English at Binghamton University, and also Hannah McGregor at Simon Fraser University. My name is Eric Klein. My co-hosts doing invisible labor every week is Jennifer Waits, who often books the guests, you know, writes down a list of questions, does the show notes, and puts the links to all these things. And those are all going to be, once again, online at radiosurvivor.com for today's episode. Links to everything we've talked about, previous episodes of Radio Survivor as well, online at radiosurvivor.com. My name is Eric Klein. Paul Riesmandel is also co-host and co-producer of this program. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you soon.